Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Immunology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives on the impact of prurigo nodularis on patients' quality of life, practical advice on making a diagnosis, and insights on available guidelines and treatments, as well as emerging therapies. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an independent educational grant from Sanofi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, my name is Sonja Stenner and I'm a professor of dermatology and neurodermatology at Münster University Hospital in Germany. And I'm very happy to welcome you today to this discussion of prurigo nodularis, improving awareness, diagnosis, management, and quality of life. And I'm also happy to be here together with international well-known experts. Here we have Professor Matthias Augustin from the University Medical Center, Hamburg-Eppendorf in Germany. Hello, Matthias.
Hi, Sonja.
And we have Dr. Sean Quatra from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, United States. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Sonja.
So today we like to discuss with you three points, and this is: what are the clinical challenges associated with prurigo nodularis, or in short PN, that contribute to the overall burden of the disease? Second is, how can PN be differentiated from other skin conditions, and what are the current management options? And number three is, which emerging treatments may help to address the current unmet need for patients with PN. So we come immediately to the first point, and we can ask ourselves, what is chronic prurigo? This is a novel term, and it's an umbrella term for a disease that is described as having a severe itch scratch cycle composed of, as it says, chronic pruritus, history or signs of scratching, and typical clinical lesions called pruriginous lesions, and they may have different phenotypes, such as they may be papules, nodules, plaques, they may be umbilicated or linear. The dominant type is prurigo nodularis, or chronic nodular prurigo, so over 70% of patients have this phenotype. And this is what we want to discuss today. Let's take a look at the clinics. What you see here on these images, it is very typical here. We see the nodules. They are excoriated, dome-shaped nodules. We also see some papules in other patients, or plaques like in this patient, which can even be melted together. From the color, they might be skin-colored red, pink, brown, or black with hyperpigmented borders. The lesions can be single, or they can be numerous, up to hundreds, even 500. Patients with 500 nodules have been recorded. Typically, the lesions are symmetrically distributed, and on the back, we frequently see a so-called butterfly sigh, where patients cannot reach with hand and cannot scratch. As I said, pruritus is a severe symptom, and this can lead to sleep disturbances, to psychosocial disturbances, and then patients might end up with depression and anxiety, and this again worsens pruritus. So here we see already that patients might have comorbidities which are related to the disease, but there may be also independent comorbidities, and a long list of these have been described and reported. And with that, this would be my first question to Dr. Quatra. Could you maybe give us some insights on the comorbidities? You did a very nice study on that.
Thanks so much, Dr. Stander, for that great overview. So we know that there are several disease comorbidities that are associated with prurigo nodularis. We know that kidney disease, hepatic disease, also type 2 diabetes, those are a few of the major things that I know we all are screening for at baseline. But then there's also several additional comorbidities that I believe may be related to this chronic uninterrupted itch-scratch cycle. So there's a greater propensity for anxiety, depression, also many sleep disorders. As we know, these patients are often scratching, and that interrupts their sleep and also while they're sleeping as well. So those are just a few of the major comorbidities that we see overall. We also see certain infectious diseases that are more common in prurigo nodularis patients. So HIV, as well as hepatitis, B and C. So that's why it's very important right when we're examining some of these prurigo nodularis patients that we get a great review of systems and are really on top of any of these different diseases that might be associated.
Yes, thank you so much. It sounds like you are seeing the disease quite frequently in your center, though we know regarding the epidemiology that it's rather a rare disease, and Dr. Augustin did some very nice studies on that. So maybe, Sean, you can give us some insights how frequently you see it, and then we will come to Dr. Augustin to give us insights into the prevalence.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think centers like ours, so, you know, both of us, and I'm sure Dr. Augustin as well, we're referral centers. So we probably see this disease way more than the general community. When I ask docs outside, they say, oh, you know, it's less common. But for us, we have a lot of these patients because they have nowhere to go. And in some of at least our U.S. Estimates, I think we found around 72 per 100,000, but other estimates say there's about over 300,000 in the U.S. I honestly believe all of this is a dramatic underestimate because we still get all these referrals and I'm seeing these patients and it's rash, non-specified, you know, all of that going on. So hopefully in the future, by doing things like this where we increase disease state awareness, we'll be able to get a true reflection of the actual prevalence.
And Dr. Augustin, you did a study. So do you confirm the data of United States?
Yes, first of all, I think in most countries it's a rare disease, which means that we tend to overlook it once it appears. And this is particularly true for those who are not used to identify the signs and symptoms of prurigo nodularis, and this is what we will talk about later. But if we take just the crude numbers in the claims data, we also find a prevalence of about 0.1, 0.2 per 1,000. This is the number that also Dr. Quadram named. And when we get into the field and do population-based studies, it's at least 5 to 10 times more frequent than supposed from the claims data. So obviously there's a confounding effect with other chronic skin conditions. Nevertheless, even in our referral center, we have much more patients with psoriasis, topical dermatitis, and less PN, though the disease burden is very large in each of those patients.
So talking now about the disease burden, so can you elaborate a little bit more about that? Do you think they have a high burden of the disease?
Mm-hmm. If we see a single patient in practice, most of them are desperate because they have been looking for help for months or even years with a high level of symptoms and suffering. And the worst experience is that other physicians didn't know what this is and didn't follow guidelines and a sound workup of the condition. So if we measure the disease burden, then large scale investigations show that the decrease of DLQI, of quality of life, is even much higher on average than in psoriasis or atopic dermatitis. So in fact, most of the patients are severely affected and are among those with the greatest losses of quality of life unless they get a good treatment.
And you just say the patients didn't get a good treatment. So do you think there's a high unmet need in these patients?
Absolutely. And we have data on this. Actually, we shared studies on this, Dr. Stender. And first of all, there's the high need on top to get rid of the pruritus, which is terrible, the sleep losses, but also secondary points like feeling desperate because there's no cure visible to them, that they feel helplessness. So there is an addition of many, many different burdensome factors, which then makes up the overall result of being in a very poor condition. And this, of course, also contributes to the comorbidity. We have just heard from Dr. Quatra that there's an increased level of depression, anxiety, many more conditions, fatigue, and they are partly at least raised by their high suffering, but also maybe by other factors regarding the chronic inflammation.
You just also mentioned atopic dermatitis, and I think it's very important to clarify here once again, this is not a subtype of atopic dermatitis. Some patients, and the number vary up to 50%, 40%, 30%, it depends on what reference you add, that the patients have an atopic background and they might have atopic dermatitis, but the other part doesn't have. So I think this is very important to clarify here, and thank you for bringing this up. I have one question again to Dr. Quatra. We all three mentioned that the patient have itch, but it's more than itch, right? Can you maybe briefly explain a little bit on that?
Absolutely, Dr. Stander. So whenever anyone asks this question or it comes up, I actually refer to your paper, your study. So you actually very elegantly showed several years ago, before prurigo nodularis was so hot and all that, you've been studying this for a long time. You found that there was an intraepidermal loss of nerves, and you found that it was there also in lesional and non-lesional skin. So to me, my perception of the symptoms in PN is based in large part on your foundational work. And actually those nerve fibers that are so disorganized and dysfunctional, I believe leads to a very unique form of symptomology. So of course it's itch, but we also see tremendous burning sensations, tremendous stinging sensations, incredible pain in several of these patients. Sometimes folks can have sensations and other things like that. And for me, it's very important to think back on the anatomy in your work. And we know that A delta fibers, which are thinly myelinated, and C fibers, which are unmyelinated, are going to be emanating through the upper layers of the dermis and even into the epidermis. And if we know that those nerve fibers are damaged, likely from chronic scratch and also endogenous neural dysregulation, then that can be one of the factors leading to these sensations. So we know itch is going through these nerves. We know temperature is going through these nerves. We know information on proprioception, and many other factors are going through the nerves. So if they are dysregulated anatomically, then it's not only itch, it's many of these other things.
No, I absolutely agree. Thank you so much. After this already very nice conversation, we come to the second part, more clinical and practical part. So, for example, how can PN be differentiated from other diagnoses? And to be very honest, it is a clinical diagnosis. So, I mean, once you saw a couple of cases, you will immediately identify that. It's always a matter of what's behind that, what's behind the pruritus, and what is behind the lesion. So sometimes the lesions cover other diseases like bullous pemphigoid, which might hide behind prurigo. And so we have a recommendation for a diagnostic workup. We do, of course, a clinical examination. We assess the PN severity, and we will discuss this later. Of course, we check if the patient has anxiety or depression, and then we are doing laboratory tests to rule out the comorbidities Dr. Quatra told us so nicely. And this also includes a malignancy screening, especially if the pruritus is in its first year. Then it might be that patient have a malignancy. So when it comes to the treatment, we have a lettered recommendation from the International Forum for the Study of Itch. This is an international guideline, the first one, and we are very happy still after 2 years that it's valid, and the field is moving forward, and this is what we are looking in a minute. So how do we start in mild cases and in any step in the moderate and severe cases with topical corticosteroids or calcineurin inhibitors, H1 antihistamines? Then we move on to capsaicin or intralesional corticosteroids. We add UV therapy. And if this is not enough or we have moderate to severe cases, we have here some sophisticated therapies, either neuronal or immunosuppressive therapies, before we move on to step four. And here we have therapies which are in clinical trials or outside, but then they're off-label, like the mu opioid receptor antagonists. And having said that, I am very happy to add that we now have the first approved treatment. Until a couple of weeks, it's dupilumab. It's an interleukin 4 receptor alpha antagonist, and it's approved for the treatment of adult patients with PN based on the data of two phase 3 trials, PRIME and PRIME 2. So we come now again to our panel discussion, and Dr. Quattro, what is your clinical experience with making the diagnosis? Is this very long, or how do you proceed in the center with your patients?
Yeah, so I proceed in a very similar fashion to what you laid out, in that folks come in and it is largely a clinical diagnosis, a chronic itch, the appearance of these intensely itchy nodules and signs of excoriations. So personally, I don't rely at all on any dermatopathology tests or anything like that. What's interesting is I've been giving this diagnosis, as we all have, and to me, to folks who have seen it regularly, it's very straightforward and not a big deal. But oftentimes, the patients have even started to cry because they've been passed around for so long without a diagnosis. So I think it really highlights the important need for greater awareness of the condition, specifically a focus on the nodules. And like you laid out, the differential diagnosis is important to look for other rare mimickers, things that may sometimes be associated with PN. So I always check to see if there are any urticarial patches or plaques, thinking about, prurigo pemphigoides. I always make sure, to double check any nodules and lesions, rule out SECs, other things like that, I think are very important in terms of clinical diagnosis. Sometimes lichen planus and darker skin tones in particular can be a little bit tricky to rule out in those situations, maybe doing a biopsy, but largely straightforward clinical diagnosis.
And it sounds like, Dr. Augustin, that we need an MTD approach in the patients. We heard that we want and have to rule out other comorbidities, but sometimes we need someone from the psychosomatic department for that. So what is your opinion and experience with that?
Yes, this is true, because the long-term disease burden, also, as you say, psychiatric comorbidity is something that we should identify as early as the proper diagnosis of PN, and also start treatment there. And in most cases, we are not the specialists, of course, for such psychiatric comorbidity, and the same accounts for cardiovascular, for metabolic and other comorbidity. But as Dr. Quattro already lined out, raising the diagnosis and having a clear treatment pattern is something that we can do on our own if it comes to the PN. So we shouldn't wait to have the patient being seen by many other disciplines before we start treatment, because we are losing a lot of time with this. So ideally, this is a dense process, but if not, then we are the drivers of the treatment plan.
And before we come to the pharmacological therapies, Dr. Quattro, are you also referring your patients to other departments, or are you using non-pharmacological treatments?
So I think that Dr. Augustine brought up excellent points. We don't want to delay care, but also we want to allow folks care when they need it from specialists. So I guess the number one referral I'm giving is to psychology or psychiatrists. And that's also because of the big comorbidities in terms of sleep disturbance that's causing psychosocial and mental distress. So that's by far the number one thing in terms of other specialists that I'm thinking about. But we're not delaying care. We're offering care. And for me, the focus is on the psychological, psychiatric aspect.
And I only can confirm what both of you were saying. And it's even that the patient needs some support in self-care, in doing exercise. What about nutrition? What would be the best way? And the biggest topic is, how can we improve the sleep? We now come to the pharmacological treatment, and we have guidelines for that. And Dr. Augustine, I'd like to ask you, you have been involved in two guidelines which also made recommendations on prurigo. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
In fact, we should always follow the guidelines because they work up the best evidence and the consensus of experts. And the international guideline that you mentioned, IFSI guideline, and the German guideline and some other national guidelines are very concordant in the proposition of topical treatment first in circumscript lesions, otherwise systemics. Regarding the systemic treatments that we should use quite early when we see that the topicals are not sufficient. Most of them until now are off-label treatments. And so we are glad that now we will get more labeled treatments, more approved drugs for the systemic treatment like dupilumab.
So, Dr. Quattro, what's about you? Are you using UV therapy still? So we are using it in Germany. Are you using that? And what's your opinion on antihistamines? I mean, we put it into the guideline because in some countries, this is more or less the first and only thing they can do and they want to do. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the UV phototherapy, you know, we actually have many patients that are improved about on that therapy. The only issue is that sometimes the onset of action and itch relief can take a considerable amount of time. So for that reason, we're often doing dual therapy off the bat, oftentimes combined with another immunomodulating agent, such as methotrexate or another agent like that. Phototherapy alone, we haven't necessarily had the greatest results, but I think in folks who have a little bit more milder to moderate disease, then that can certainly be a great option as monotherapy. If it's very extensive, hundreds of nodules, that's where I found monotherapy with UV therapy can be a little bit more challenging. For antihistamines, the non-sedating antihistamines, we found to be pretty ineffective. And now that we know more about the itch pathways in terms of histaminergic or non-histaminergic, that makes sense. Having said that, the sedating antihistamines in particular can have sedative effects, which can help relieve itch. So when patients are really struggling, in particular, sedating antihistamines can sometimes help with acute relief.
We now come to the last part about the novel therapies which are in the pipeline. And for that, of course, we had to understand the pathogenesis of PM. And as Dr. Katra already outlined, we have a disturbance of the nerve fibers. We also have a disturbance of the epithelia, so the epidermis. It's not only altered in anatomy, but also in function. And in addition, we have many inflammatory cells like the T cells, especially TH2 cells, mast cells, eosinophils, and basophils, which release pruritogens and also play a role in the pathogenesis of prurigo. What separates this disease from other inflammatory diseases is that it's establishing a fibrosis, and you see that really all cell types in the skin are affected. Accordingly, we need therapies who act on all these cell types, so they block the efficacy and the signaling of these interleukins. We need therapies who block the effects of released neuropeptides. We have to have therapies who block the keratinocyte metabolism. And fortunately, we have already therapies in the pipeline. And as I said, dupilumab is already approved in the United States and hopefully in the future also in other countries. And here you see once again the results of the two phase three trials, the PRIME and PRIME 2, you see that their primary outcome was a 4-point or more reduction on the worst itch numeric rating scale. And this was measured at week 24, 60% had this criterion versus 18.4 in placebo. This was significant. And in the PRIME 2 study, this was measured at week 12. And you see a lower number, but still significant percentage of patients achieved these goals. In nemolizumab, this is an interleukin 31 antibody. We have also two phase 3 studies. And the first is finished and is already positive. And you see here the same criterion, but at week 16, we had also a high number of patients who had a control of the itching. And you see here another criterion, the investigator global assessment. 0 to 1, that means that the patient had a healing and almost or no lesions at week 16, and 38% of the patient achieved this. And also in the dupilumab phase 3 trials, the IgE 0 to 1 was significant, and up to 40% of the patient had this criterion. So there are more substances in the pipeline. Nalbuphine, that is a combined kappa opioid receptor agonist and mu opioid receptor antagonist. We have a JAK inhibitor, abrocitinib, and vixarelimab, also another interleukin 31 receptor antibody addressed to the subcomponent OSMRβ. And this study, nalbuphine, just reported positive results. The others are still in the development. Vixarelimab is in its phase 2 stage. So here you see there is a lot of hope for our patient and new therapies to come. So I just now mentioned the efficacy, and Dr. Quatra, you were also engaged and involved in the design and the study programs and saw a lot of these data. So what do you think about the safety of the drugs?
Yeah, I think this is incredible advancement to have targeted monoclonal antibodies. One of the main limitations of current therapies is their non-specificity. So if you look at drugs like methotrexate, which can affect the kidneys, the liver, cyclosporine, which can affect the kidneys as well, and affect so many nonspecific targets, it is a tremendous advancement for our patients. And I'd like to emphasize that these patients are older on average than atopic dermatitis and psoriasis patients. Their average age is middle-aged, and so it highlights even more how having a very targeted, directed approach is going to be incredibly important in the management of PN patients.
Yeah, thank you. These are very important points. And the question is now, we have a repertoire of novel therapies, but who is the appropriate patient to receive that? Dr. Augustin, what do you think? How can we come here to a conclusion?
First of all, of course, we need to follow the clinical data from the RCTs, from the trials, and then try to gain as much information from our daily practice, from real world, like with registries as well. That's the foundation for the clinical effectiveness. But if it comes to the question, Dr. Stender, how do patients qualify for the systemic treatment overall, then there should be clear criteria for this. And it's for sure that those who fail with topicals and phototherapy should get systemics. And but many deserve them at the very first moment, of course. And we have defined criteria for this that are well applicable in practice. One being that there needs to be a visible disease burden, and we define at least 20 visible and relevant prurigo lesions as a qualifying criteria. Another would be the prurigo IgA activity of more than 3. You developed, actually, Dr. Stender, an excellent tool which has been validated with the prurigo activity score, which also paves the way. But also we need to be clear about the subjective burden of the patients, and we should measure them. The pruritus with the worst itch numerical rating scale, the quality of life losses with DAQI. And again, there are thresholds for this. And so one of the objective criteria, one of the subjective should fit, and then we can start a systemic treatment.
Yes, thank you very much also for mentioning the IgA. And it was a long process to develop new instruments, which are valid and accepted also by the health authorities, which can be used in clinical trials. So we started with 0, and we made interviews and investigated the patients. And then we saw that the best way to define the disease severity is by the number of nodules. And in addition to use the already established instrument for the pruritus measurement, the NRS, and this explains that we didn't construct a tool which assembles both, but we separate the NRS. We use the same itch instrument used in all other trials for AD, psoriasis, and so on. And for the disease severity, we consider the number of the lesions. And as you said, we have the moderate PN starts from having 20 to 100 nodules, and severe is from over 100 nodules. And Dr. Quattro, you mentioned already that your patients with UV therapy, they do not show lesion clearance, and you mentioned those who have severe PN. So how long do you expect them to stay on the novel therapy? So when you use Dupi, or in the future, maybe we have Nemo or others. So what do you think? Will this change our treatment behavior?
Well, I think we're still gathering information. So atopic dermatitis and psoriasis, we know, tend to be very chronic diseases. Prurigo nodularis starts a little bit later in life, middle age and on. But from everything we know, it is a chronic therapy. It will need, longstanding treatment. But what I will say is we're going to learn more in the near future. Some of the trials that are in design have durability aspects. So after the drug is given, we'll be able to see how long the effect lasts. I also, from my own experience, have some patients who have been on agents like methotrexate. They got better. We tried to taper down the dose. And in some folks, they were able to get off therapy. But I expect the lion's share of patients will probably need to have chronic therapy.
And Dr. Augustin, when you hear chronic therapy, and you mentioned already registers, so can you give us insights why we need registers?
Yes, actually, I think especially in the case of a rare disease like chronic prurigo, we should try to get all evidence available, all experience available, and connect our insights from the single centers into a large database, because then we progress much faster, and we can better differentiate and find out which treatment really is the best, has the best prediction of response for which patient. And for this, registries are essential. And besides of this, they are also the best control for the drug safety. As Dr. Quattro already lined out, the drugs that we now have, the biologicals, they are excitingly safe, and they can be used long term. But nevertheless, we need to control this and follow up patients also for the sake of safety.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we are already at the end of our nice discussion, and I want to thank really both of you. It was again a fantastic conversation, and thanks for sharing here your experience and thoughts about the treatments in the future. I think we learned a lot about the prevalence, the clinics, the differential diagnosis, how to treat currently the patients along the guideline, and about the future therapies. And with that, I want to thank our audience and listeners, and I'm happy to see you in the future again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, my name is Sonja Stender, and I'm happy to welcome you today on this follow-up discussion on prurigo nodularis. The most exciting information is that we now have an approval of the first drug, and this is dupilumab. It was FDA and EMA approved. We can now have it and treat our patient with that. We, in the last discussion, we took a look at the data from the PRIME studies, and we saw that a large proportion of the patient responded with reduction of itch and also healing of the lesions. And since then, we have a couple of more analyses, and I really like to invite my friend and colleague, Sean Quatra, to comment on this. What is your take on dupilumab, Sean?
Absolutely. So first off, what a remarkable change in the landscape of prurigo nodularis. We've gone so many years with terrible treatment options, and we now have our first FDA-approved therapy. And I think that alone has made a huge difference, seeing and treating patients, having to fight less to get them drugs that we know are safe and effective. So to me, having that drug approved has remarkably changed our landscape. And personally, we've been able to have real-world experience, both of us and many others, with dupilumab, and being able to see how it works in the real world in terms of reducing itch and also flattening nodules, you know, largely consistent with the results that we're seeing in these clinical trials.
Yeah, so let's stay a little bit in our experience. So in the trials, we saw that there is a 4-point reduction of itch starting at week 2. And it's maintained through week 12 and week 24. These have been the endpoints. And so what is your experience on this clinically?
You know, I would say it can be a bit heterogeneous in terms of how fast it happens. So in some folks, it's just within a few days. In other folks, it's months. Mm-hmm. And other rare folks may need a little bit longer. But what I've seen is that overall, folks tend to have that itch melt first and then the nodules resolve. But the biology is so interesting in that, you know, some folks may melt very quickly and other folks may take a little bit longer. Have you seen similar experiences at the bedside?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see patients who are very, very happy report that the itch is immediately controlled. And we have the opposite spectrum, that some come after months and tell us, no, there is no movement. And this is when we start to think, okay, what other component do they have in their comorbidities? Maybe a psychiatric component. We know that these patients who have psychiatric comorbidities are in general harder to treat. What is your take on that?
Absolutely. And the other thing we think about is sometimes maybe folks have a little bit broader immune involvement as well. We know that type 2 inflammation is very important, but also, you know, we're not hesitating to also offer folks things like intralesional steroid injections or phototherapy, multimodal therapy. So that's still part of the armamentarium, you know, when we're approaching and treating these patients.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we are also using additional therapies, not necessarily systemic therapies, but as you say, intralesional corticosteroids, UV therapy. So not so many of my German colleagues are in favor of that. So in fact, outside hospitals, they are very reserved to use it. Is it the same in US?
I think less so that we're reserved to use it, but more so that it can be just burdensome on the patient to have to come in to a phototherapy unit 2 to 3 times a week. Sometimes that's a lot on the patients, and it's slower. So I think most patients opt to go for some of these novel therapies. However, you know, I've seen some pretty good results if people can stay patient. And oftentimes with, you know, drug like dupilumab, you know, sometimes we'll combine therapies and then give the drug a little bit of time to get going. It's just very personalized how folks like to treat their disease. So oftentimes give everyone all the options and then, you know, let them decide. Sometimes it's that there isn't a phototherapy unit. It's like 100 miles away and then they actually can't.
Yeah. That's right. And you just mentioned type 2 inflammation. So did you saw any difference in Dupi use between patients who have atopic predisposition or AD, in fact, and those who don't have?
Yeah, so it's very interesting because in the trials, they did include folks who had mild, a history of either mild atopic dermatitis or a history of it as well. And it looked as though those who had at least one of these atopic comorbidities, so allergic rhinitis, which is very common in the population, atopic dermatitis or asthma, had kind of a similar phenotype. What we're seeing is that it's a little bit beyond atopic, non-atopic. And we have many folks who come in who have signs of type 2 inflammation, but not atopy. So a lot of high eosinophils and IgE that those patients have, and then they respond really well to dupilumab as well. So I think the atopic, non-atopic is becoming less of an issue and a concern because we see that there's still efficacy, and more like, is type 2 inflammation the driving factor, which we know it's very important in the majority of PN patients.
I really like it that you say that, because this is also our experience here, that if the patients have atopy or if they don't have atopy and whatever etiology they have in addition, that doesn't play a role. So once the patient have prurigo nodularis, they have the disease. And so you would not necessarily treat them different if they have the prurigo due to chronic kidney disease or due to atopic dermatitis. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, some of those patients who have chronic kidney disease or HIV have been some of the best responders to dupilumab therapy in my regard, too. So less likely about, you know, what contributing etiologies are. Totally agree.
Yeah, fantastic. So let's jump to the pipeline. And we still have a lot of drugs in the pipeline, as we discussed last time. And we know a little bit more about nemolizumab. So last time we already reported that Olympia 2 phase 3 was positive. And now we learned on the conferences a little bit more about the analysis of the data. And what was striking to me was the analysis around those patients who have an average weekly NRS below 2, that was really a high proportion of patients. So it was at week 16, 35% of the nemo-treated population had that, and placebo was around 7%. So this is really telling us that itch is really controlled. And does this surprise you? You have also been there on this conference, so.
Yeah, so it's very interesting because it seems to be working fast. And so within a few weeks, a remarkable number of folks are having that significant itch relief. And what you said is, now it seems like we're shifting the goalposts. It's maybe not just a 4-point drop, but those folks who can get down to even less than 2 into that relative itch-free state. So it does look like nemolizumab's able to do that. The other thing that's very interesting is that the improvement is sleep, which we know is tied to the itch, is very apparent if you chart it out in these nemo patients. So as itch improves, sleep improves right with it. So it seems to have that, you know, remarkable effect on both itch and sleep as well. And this is, as you said, is, you know, the farthest along therapeutic as well, other than dupilumab, which is FDA approved. So already have these phase 3 trials. So very exciting time.
So you did a lot of wonderful research in prurigo. So every paper, pathophysiology comes from your laboratory. This is really amazing. And so can you give us a little bit more insight maybe into the nemo mode of action, or how it interferes in prurigo with the immunologic background?
Yeah, so nemolizumab is, you know, targeting IL-31 receptor alpha, which is very important because it's on a lot of these immune cells that are exaggerated in prurigo nodularis lesions in blood. So those eosinophils, basophils, many of those important immune cells. But it's also exaggerated, as you know, we know, on the nerves that are in the skin and also in the dorsal root ganglion and the spinal cord. So you have both that effect of targeting the immune cells and the direct transmission of that neural message. So when you actually inject IL-31, you develop dose response in terms of how itchy you get. So the key here is the central dogma. Is it the rash that itches, or is it the itch that rashes? And it seems like in prurigo nodularis, it's the itch that's become so dominant. And the other interesting thing is, you know, in our study together where we looked at those patients from the phase two, which you were the global lead on, Sonia, we also found that the inflammation in the bloodstream is coming way down with nemolizumab. To me, this is really interesting because everybody says, okay, you have a prurigo nodularis patient. You want to do a workup for disease comorbidities. But we also know now that actually having prurigo nodularis means that you have more circulating mediators of blood inflammation. And my personal hypothesis has been that those cells, if left unchecked, can lead to a lot of these different comorbidities. So if we have the potential here for novel therapeutics to reduce this blood inflammation, I mean, with registry studies and other studies in the future, we'll be looking to see, does this decrease actually some of these comorbidities from developing in the first place? Which at that point, we go beyond being just dermatologists, Sonia, then we are actually, you know, treating the whole body.
No, but that's a very interesting hypothesis. We have to say it's still a hypothesis. And we will read in your next paper the proof. But it's similar to psoriasis, yeah? The story is similar to psoriasis, that you have a systemic inflammation that also drives the comorbidities. And this makes a lot of sense to me.
And then, Sonia, the other thing I want to say is you were the first person to describe in prurigo nodularis this disrupted neural architecture. So one thing that I'm very curious to see from your work also in the future is, how does therapy with nemolizumab or dupilumab, you know, normalize the structure of those nerves?
Yeah, this is also one abstract we had prepared that when you have atopic dermatitis, where you have also neuroarchitectural disturbances, and you treat with Dupi, that there is a restoration. And so this is really very interesting. And this also contributes, of course, to the relief of itching. I want to ask you, and this is very important, what about the genes? The genetics in prurigo?
Yeah, no, it's very important. So, you know, recently we looked into the question more about why, because, you know, both of us have lots of prurigo nodularis patients. They always ask us why, and we're not quite sure. But one thing we do know is it's a little different from eczema or psoriasis, which emerges earlier in life. Prurigo tends to emerge more in middle age. The question is, what's the role of genes versus the environment? And so we did this initial study where we, you know, took patient samples and their genomes that we sequenced. And what we found is that there actually is a polygenic risk score. So that's the summation of the patterns of all the genes in your body. And that pattern can predict a diagnosis of prurigo nodularis. So that was in two independent, continentally distinct populations that we found. And so it seems to be that there's more of a two-hit hypothesis in PN. Some folks tend to be genetically susceptible to having these nodules and skin lesions versus itch on normal skin. But then the search is on for, what are those things that actually trigger it? Is it having impaired blood glucose with the type 2 diabetes, or, you know, trending towards chronic kidney disease, or microbiome elements? So it seems like there's both genetics and environment that are coming together to create this condition.
Yeah, wonderful. And we will learn more from you about that. And these are very, very important papers. We can conclude by mentioning that we still have some very interesting drugs in the pipeline. We have abrocitinib as a JAK inhibitor. We have nalbuphine. We have vixarelimab. But there is nothing fundamental new regarding the studies. We still have to wait to their outcome, and maybe we see us next time here again discussing that. So thank you very much, Sean. It was really a pleasure again to discuss with you, and yeah, we see you soon.
Thank you so much for having me. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this and related topics on Touch Immunology at www.touchimmunology.com. Do keep checking back for any updates as we launch further activities on prurigo nodularis and chronic prurigo.